It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
I feel like a locomotive sipping, drinking Arizona. Mixtape just around the corner. Did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like song, and then my song's gon' break through like a
rocket. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. It is all up to speed with Formula One. It is Wednesday, September 27th, 2023. Mark Daly is here tonight, joined by the somewhat snazzy and sharply dressed Mr. Mark Hamilton. Dude, did you just come back from a photo shoot or something? I mean, the hair is all nicely done. You know, it's like you're looking good, my friend. What's the occasion?
So little do people know, but I have done a little bit of stock photography modeling in the past. My total earnings career to date is $1.65 because, of course, you earn commissions based on the usage of your photo. So I haven't been a very effective stock photography model. But we were downtown today at the office jamming, getting some work done. It was a long day. It was a great day. I feel really good. And I'm super excited to be here to talk to you about Taylor Swift. And you thought I was going to be super negative about celebrities and the NFL ecosystem. Dude, I find that celebrities in the NBA and celebrities in the NFL, they coexist so effectively, unlike Formula One. But you're an NFL fan. How much impact or how much ripple has this caused in the world of the NFL? Because if you don't know, earlier this week at Kansas City Chiefs, that's the team.
Yes. Yep. That's right. You got it. Kansas City Chiefs. So, yep. Taylor Swift was there at Kansas the game City on Sunday Chiefs. At Arrowhead. Because the rumor is, that she's stating superstar Travis Kelce. And so here we go. There's the rumors have to be true because Taylor Swift was there in a luxury box, all dressed up in Chiefs gear and things like that. So, the old saying where there's smoke, there's fire. So there's something obviously there. And then I tweeted something about, enough with the celebrities. I'm here to watch the game, kind of get it back to the game. First, I get a tweet back from our good friend Joe Santucci. He said, "Well, watch it before the Swifties pile on." I didn't realize that, I didn't want to fall foul of the Swifties, but this funny, I don't really care for the whole celebrity thing. I know it's kind of like some people think it's kind of cool. I'm just like, just show me the sports.
I don't want the sports. I want to see what the athletes are wearing. I want to see what they're driving. I want to hear what they think about the presidential election. Like, I'm all in on everything but the sport. By the way, my buddy, I don't know if you know this, but ChatGPT has evolved pretty significantly this week. It can now talk to you. It can now listen to you. You can feed it photos and it'll dissect photos. But it's also allegedly up to date on the latest news. And my buddy sent me a screenshot. He went to ChatGPT and he said, "Who is Taylor Swift's most recent love interest?" To which ChatGPT responded, "As of my last update, Taylor Swift's love life and relationship are private matters, and it's essential to respect her privacy." ChatGPT then goes on to share all the details of all of her past relationships. So, ChatGPT, there you go.
There you go. So, I wonder, one of these days, do you ever feel like we could be replaced by ChatGPT or some other AI or something that could come back and then we'll be replaced? Yes. We'll log into the studio and there'll be like virtual AI versions of ourselves doing the show.
The locks will be changed. No, the locks will just be changed on our studios.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? All right. Well, let's jump into it. So you kind of like jumped ahead in the show schedule. So first of all, just to show a little bit of love to Magnus and the crew over at theraceweekend.com. Head on over to the Race Weekend. That's RACEWKND.com. Enter in our promo code ScuderiaPod at checkout. Receive 10% off a subscription. And then also check out
We get the commission.
Exactly. And whoever gets the subscription gets an amazing coffee table style it's just an amazing publication. I love Magnus and the work that they do. Also, check out racingexclusive.com. They have generously provided us the 1/2 scale autographed Max Verstappen helmet that we will give away to the winner of our F1 Fantasy League, which is going to come up pretty soon. I mean, we are literally in the stretchiest part of the stretch run. How many races do we have left now? 6? It seems like Six. We went from like 9 down to like,
too many.
Yeah, we're kind of there, aren't we? Anyways, go ahead on over to racingexclusive.com to find unique Formula One merchandise, all of which comes with a certificate of authenticity. Las Vegas watch party, Mark. Give us the deets on what's happening with the watch party.
53 days away, you will have the opportunity, if you live in the greater Vancouver area or are willing to trek in, to jam with Mark Daly and Mark Hamilton from 10 p.m. until midnight, watching live a very chilly, because it's going to be cold. Remember, this is November, the desert in Nevada. It's going to be a little bit chilly. I don't know how they're going to keep those tires warm, but we're going to watch the first ever Las Vegas Grand Prix live from my house, and it will be fully catered. So if you like delicious foods and things like that, Mark Daly and I will be going to Costco earlier that day to load up. So that's coming super fast. I think 53 days, my friend.
It's crazy, right? A little bit off topic here, but I can't believe we're almost into the month of October. I feel that it just as soon as we hit Labor Day, it's just like everything just accelerated like crazy. I can't believe it. It's absolutely nuts. Okay, do you have the fantasy standings teed up, my friends?
Yeah, I do, but I'm going to talk very slowly as the page loads. Obviously,
so while you do that, I will rescue you.
No. I've got it. No rescuing necessary, but I appreciate the effort. And you could probably hear me frantically clicking in the background. But there's been big changes. And if you listened on Sunday, you probably already know that. But if you didn't tune in, and to be honest, I don't know why anyone would be tuning in for the post-race recaps at this point. I just, please tune in. We need the sponsorship money and we need your love. Sitting in number one, Michael Kranji, 16. Number two, Matt Noob, team 3, followed by Vince Dest, 2, Matt Noob, team 3. Relampago Marquinhos, and then Bengals Bubs, Crash Team Racing 1, Gotivi Team, The Bad Guys Bye Bye, Axis Mon, Yellow Racing, Aaron Kirilenen, sorry, Aaron, I ruined your name, Lion F1, FPL Rossoneri Team 1, and then also last place. But the big takeaway here right now is we still have 6 races left, like you said, and there are only 58 points separating the first and second place team. And even Vince Dest, you know what? Vince Dest slipped from one to three, but he's only 61 points behind. And of course, if you need any incentive to continue to focus on your fantasy team, the grand prize is, again, a signed Max Verstappen 1/2 scale championship helmet with a certificate of authenticity.
Yes, I got a feeling that Vince is going to make some moves. The man, the myth, the legend, which is kind of cool how we got to know who Vince actually is. You know, the radio host in the wonderful, beautiful city of Montreal, which I'm so overdue to go and visit because I love Montreal so much. But maybe I'll wait till after the winter. I was there in the summer. It was gorgeous. And I'm reminiscing. And of course, I got to do a couple laps around Circuit Gilles Villeneuve in my brother-in-law's BMW, which was fun. And, you know, fun fact, actually not so fun fact, but they have a speed limit around Circuit Gilles Villeneuve of 30 kilometers an hour, which, you know, isn't very exciting, but you get passed by people on rollerblades and bikes and people walking babies and strollers. But still, it's an experience and it's kind of cool. You can actually just roll right in your ride and do a lap around Circuit Gilles Villeneuve. Okay, Drivers' Championship. Max Verstappen, 400 points even. Sergio Perez, 223. Lewis Hamilton, 190. Closing in on Sergio Perez, Fernando Alonso. I was almost going to say Fernando Hamilton. What a bad mashup that would have been. You know, 2008 Fernando and 2008 Lewis Hamilton would not approve, and maybe their contemporary selves don't approve either. Anyways, Fernando fourth with 174 points. Carlos Sainz rounds out the top 5 with 150. Then we have Charles Leclerc, Lando Norris, George Russell, Oscar Piastri, and Lance Stroll rounding out the top 10. Over on the constructors' side, it was clinched this past weekend by Red Bull at the Japanese Grand Prix. They have 623 points. Mercedes 305, Ferrari 285, Aston Martin 221, McLaren 172. Expect that there will be changes in those other positions in the constructors. I know it's all for second and best of the rest and all that, but it's still, it's something to kind of keep an eye on. I'm trying to pump up second place. You know, what did Senna, what was Senna's quote? So that second is the first of the losers. So, you know, so you should still watch. Please watch the rest of the season. Please continue to listen to our podcast. And we got to change the subject here, Mark, before, you know, we completely lose it. Anyways, somebody that isn't losing is Oscar Piastri. He joins a long, long list of fellow Australians that have been podium winners, podium places in Formula. That includes Jack Brabham, Schenken, Alan Jones, Weber, Ricardo, Piastri himself. So, I mean, there's some very, very impressive names on that list. So Piastri, the sixth Australian to win a podium, place at a podium in a Formula One race. So that's awesome. It was good to see. And wow, has he really shot up in people's, like on the radar pretty quick, especially since they got those upgrades in Australia, sorry, in Austria. So the time, this is a funny one. I love how you dug this one up. So we had this weird situation at the Japanese Grand Prix last week when Sergio Perez retired from the race on like what, lap 18 or something like that, after basically playing Mario Kart or bumper cars and everything, piled up a whole bunch of penalties. So they retired the car in lap 15, lap 18, whatever it was. Then they put him back out on the track, so he didn't have to carry that that penalty forward to the Qatar Grand Prix, which is coming up here next weekend. He would have had a grid penalty there. So instead of saying that he'd retired and unretired, they just counted it as officially a 41-minute pit stop, which, you know, Red Bull are always one of the fastest when it comes to pit stops in Formula One. So that's, you know, obviously there's an asterisk beside that because they're usually like 2 seconds, sub 2 seconds is Red Bull, right? So it's
imagine if you had to average out all of your pit stops for the season and you're like 2.5, 3 second average pit stop would climb to like, I don't know, 22 minutes. It's obscene. Just on that note as well, and I didn't manage to stick this in the story or in the outline because quite frankly, I forgot. But according to Crash.net, the FIA is not rushing to close the loophole Red Bull exposed with Sergio Perez at the F1 Japanese Grand Prix. And initially, this conversation was kind of sparked because Ted Kravitz, of course, Sky's F1 pit lane reporter, had himself reported that the FIA were keen to address the loophole in time for the next race in Doha. According to Ted Kravitz, he was a DNF, and then he was not. Then he was a DNF again. And he goes on to kind of quote that he's got some inside sources that are very confident that this is going to be addressed quickly. Of course, there's been some conflicting reports since then. And I think as much slander as Red Bull got for this conduct of effectively retiring a car, realizing they were going to have to serve a penalty in Doha and sticking him out again. I mean, ultimately, they didn't breach any rules. And we talk so much about how F1 teams have to push the boundaries of the rules and regulations to be successful. I have no issue with this. I mean, if this is an issue in the rules, close the loophole, change the rules. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they may have just exposed something pretty unique. And maybe other teams wouldn't have thought of this or wouldn't have wanted to do it because of the bad publicity. Mm-hmm. But I don't really blame them for doing it, right? Like, it's ultra competitive and they want to put him in the best possible place to bounce back next week. And starting the race in Doha with a 5-second penalty is a pretty bad way to pick up after a horror show of a Japanese Grand Prix for Sergio Perez.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't know where this kind of rates in like the longest pit stops in Formula One history, but if I was Sergio and that goes down the record books as like the longest pit stop in Formula One history, I flex on that record every day of the week. You know, it's just like one of those crazy, stupid stats,
no one,
right?
No one is ever going to break. Obviously, we all remember Valtteri Bottas in Monaco in 2021. I guess it was 2021 when the pneumatic gun basically burned off the teeth on the hub of the wheel.
Yeah.
Do you remember this? And they couldn't get the wheel off and they basically had to send the car back to the UK, basically still assembled because they couldn't get that one corner off. That is maybe the longest pit stop of all time.
Yeah, that's a fair call because, you know, when they pack up from a Grand Prix, they literally disassemble these cars like giant Lego kits and put them back into boxes and things like that and ship them back to the factory or to the next race and stuff like that. But that was the weirdest situation ever. I mean, here you have Bottas going in to change, you know, the tires. It goes in for a scheduled pit stop. You see like little shards of aluminum flying
smoke,
all over the place.
Just smoke puff. Like the teeth just puff. they were gone. Yeah. And it was so, like, in hindsight, you didn't realize that is what had happened. And then they were still, like, jabbing the pneumatic gun onto the hub, trying to get the wheel off. Guys, there's nothing there for it to bite onto. Like, that mechanic must have felt, and again, you know, he was criticized at the time, he missed his marks, blah, blah, blah. But your mechanics adjust. But yeah, that was a freak accident, man. Like, yeah. I've never seen that happen before.
Yeah, that was a weird one. so maybe that's one of those points of honor, badges of honor that they go and joke about when they sit down and have a beer together. So next one here. So with Oscar's podium last week in Japan, that now means half of the drivers on the grid this year have scored a podium, which is pretty interesting.
Pretty good, man. Pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, because, you know, everybody's been focusing on Red Bull and Verstappen dominance, which obviously has made a lot of headlines, and rightfully so, and depending on your point of view. But quietly, you have the rest of the drive, other nine drivers, getting podium finishes there. I think that's extraordinary. Now, so this year has a very quiet, silly season. For those of you who don't know what silly season is, that's the time of year when drivers tend to move around, it's the driver market, and some years are busier than others with the contracts that expire, as if there's actually any like weight to a Formula One contract. I mean, they're all written on the back of McDonald's napkins and things like that, which we always joke about, and then they get locked up in some safety deposit box in Geneva or somewhere like that. They never see the light of day. It's not like, you know, somebody signs a new contract in the NBA or Major League Baseball is like 10 years, $500 million, whatever
enshrined
it is.
Enshrined by a collective bargaining agreement too, right?
Exactly.
Like enshrined by a CBA. Yeah.
But it's interesting. We don't need to go down the whole Formula One contract rabbit hole again. But what is really interesting, should they actually have any sort of like weight behind them whatsoever, there are a lot of drivers that are coming up to the end of their deals. They'll end at the end of 2024. That includes Alex Albon, Nico Hülkenberg, Kevin Magnussen, Yuki Tsunoda, Danny Ricciardo, Lance Stroll, Fernando Alonso, Zhou Guanyu, Valtteri Bottas, Pierre Gasly, Esteban Ocon, Carlos Sainz, Charles Leclerc, and Sergio Perez. So basically everyone. the only drivers that have like multi-year deals in place is Oscar Piastri, confirmed at McLaren till the end of 26. Then you have Lando Norris, confirmed at McLaren to the end of 25. George Russell and Lewis Hamilton, who just announced new contract extensions, just was about a month or 6 weeks ago. They're going to be at Mercedes until the end of 2025. And then you have Max Verstappen, who signed like literally a 100-year extension. He's going to be, well, not 100 years. He's confirmed to be at Red Bull until the end of 2028. And then you have Logan Sargeant, who's basically living on borrowed time. He is out of the contract at the end of this season. So that's going to be very, very interesting. We could see some big moves in, coming up, new deals being announced next year. I mean, both the Ferrari drivers, Sergio Perez, I mean, there's three very, very desirable seats right there. Both the Aston Martin seats coming up. So who knows? Should be kind of fun to watch. So another fun stat that you dug up here, Mark, I like this one too. Well, Lando doesn't like this one. So Lando Norris now has the most World Driver Championship points without a win. Lando has 543 points on 98 starts in his F1 career. Nico Hülkenberg has 530 points on 197. Did I say 543 for Lando? I hope I did. 530 for Nico Hülkenberg from 197. Roman Grosjean, 179 starts, 391 points. Nick Heidfeld, 183 starts, 259 points. Lance Stroll, 137 starts. That's crazy. I can't believe Lance has been, well, I mean, first year was what, 2017?
2017.
That went pretty quick. Alex Albon is in the list too. From 75 starts, he's got 222 points. I think that's, you know, quite a remarkable stat for Alex Albon, because he hasn't always had the best car. He obviously would have picked up a lot of points in that. What did he get? Like half the back end of one season and the front half of another season before Helmut Marko and Christian Horner decided he wasn't worthy enough to drive a Red Bull anymore, and then booted him out the door for Pierre Gasly, and he was booted out. Or no, he came after Gasly. No, he replaced Gasly, didn't he? I can't keep this straight anymore.
As a point of reference, I pulled this up real quick because I thought it would be interesting to share. But you're right. The front half of 2019, he was with Toro Rosso and he replaced Gasly in the second half. He finished 2019 on 92 points. He competed in the entire shortened 2020 season. Remember, it was just that 17 race season. He scored 105 points. Sat out 2021. He scored 4 points last year and 21 points. So yeah, he scored, I guess, 197 points in his 2 years with Red Bull / Toro Rosso.
Very, very cool. All right. So why don't we take a quick break here, Mark?
Hey,
you got something else. All right.
I do. Before we go to break, I interject. I'm such a jerk. Hey. We should probably plan this a little bit better. But I have an interesting, I found something interesting on Reddit that I just have to share. And it kind of ties in perfectly to that comment about Lance Stroll, 241 points and 137 starts. He's been in F1 since 2017. So somebody sent this screenshot on Reddit, and I apologize, I don't have the credit for the individual, but they asked ChatGPT, and Mark's rolling his eyes at this point. It's like, damn it, Hamilton. Like, ChatGPT can't be the source of all of our material. But they asked ChatGPT, I'm in a TV show and I need to convince the host that Lance Stroll is the best F1 driver ever. Which arguments or stats should I use? To which ChatGPT responds, if you find yourself in a situation where you need to make an argument for Lance Stroll being the best F1 driver ever, you can use the following points to support your argument. And it's so here are the points: youth and potential. Lance made his F1 debut at a very young age, which demonstrates his incredible potential for the future. He had the opportunity to learn and grow in the sport, potentially surpassing the achievements of older drivers. False. I mean, he did start when he was young. Podium finishes. Highlight his podium finishes, of which he has 3. While he might not have as many wins as some other drivers, he has none. His ability to secure podium finishes demonstrates his skill and consistency. While I think 3 podiums and 137 starts is pretty poor. Adaptability. Discuss his ability to adapt to different teams and cars. Stroll has driven for multiple teams in his career. Wrong. He's driven for 2 teams. Strong qualifying performance. Emphasize his strong qualifying performance. Stroll has shown the ability to qualify well, which is crucial in F1. Investment in young talent. Mention his role in promoting young talent in F1. Stroll's presence in the sport could be seen as a positive for younger drivers looking to break into the field. Again, it's helpful if you have a billionaire father. Personal growth. Highlight any personal growth and improvement over the years. Discuss how he has developed as a driver since his debut. I think his development is really flatlined. Team loyalty. Talk about his loyalty to his teams and his commitment to their success. This one is hilarious because, of course, he and his father bailed on Williams after 2018 when they realized that the lack of upward trajectory, and his dad then bought a team that his son is now allegedly quote-unquote committed to. And then finally, and I love this one, and you'll love this one, Daily, the 8th and final reason that Lance Stroll is apparently the greatest driver of all time, according to ChatGPT, Canadian representation. If the TV show is based in Canada or has a Canadian audience, you can emphasize his role in representing Canada in Formula One, which can be a source of national pride, which is absolutely true.
Oh my gosh, you know, that is hilarious. But you know, I just want to point this out, Mark. You're getting all this stuff from ChatGPT for the show tonight. I just got a message from Wikipedia and Reddit. They're both very upset that they might be
they've been replaced.
They've been replaced.
The source of knowledge for the show has been replaced. By the way, you know, let's be honest, like ChatGPT is just scraping both of those. So that's where all of its intel comes from anyways.
Well, at least, you know, maybe we can still turn to Reddit, Wikipedia for, you know, quote unquote facts. We can go to ChatGPT for humor. So maybe that's where its place is. So anyways, now let's take a quick break. We'll come back on the flip side and we got some breaking news to talk about. So we'll do that in just a moment. We'll be right back. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
All right, here we go. Back again into the news now, Mark, because we've got some interesting things to talk about this week. And Sebastian Vettel, four-time world champion. Yeah, has anybody forgot about Seb? I don't think so. So what's happening with Sebastian Vettel, Mark?
Well, if you haven't noticed, and I think most of our audience has, it seems like he's sniffing around the F1 paddock a little bit. And he's obviously been very present at a couple of races this season, including in Japan. Of course, the Japanese Grand Prix, Suzuka is obviously one of his favorite circuits, and he was there with his B initiative and things like that. But it is interesting that for a driver who retired, his presence in F1 doesn't seem to have diminished in a meaningful way. And there's been a tremendous amount of speculation over the last couple of weeks and months that maybe he's looking for an opportunity to return to the grid. In fact, in an interview with British media recently, he was specifically asked that question, and he didn't deny the potential interest or desire to return to F1. But a couple of days ago over at motorsport.com, Gary Watkins is reporting that Vettel is now in talks with Jota Porsche team about a 2024 WEC drive. So even if it's not F1, it sounds like Sebastian Vettel is very much motivated to get back into competitive motorsports, and maybe potentially that leads to an opportunity to rejoin the Formula One grid at some point. You know, it must be really tough for Vettel that he spent 2 years with Aston Martin. And I could argue that he seemed somewhat uninspired, at least outwardly. And I can't challenge how hard he was working because I don't really know. But it must have been pretty tough for him to walk away and then see Alonso with the weapon that he had through the first half of this season. But it's also important to remember as well that Sebastian Vettel is himself still relatively young. He was born July 3rd, 1987, making him just, again, Wikipedia, baby, just making him 36 years old. And if he was to rejoin the Formula One grid, he certainly wouldn't be the oldest driver by any margin. And maybe there's an opportunity for him in the future. I guess it just depends, right? That if he's open to committing to the WEC, why would he not be committed to like joining Formula One team? So I think it's interesting. I just think it's interesting they spend a lot of time around the Formula One grid. And of course, let me be clear, like committing to a WEC driver is not like committing to a 22 race Formula One championship. They're two very different things. But obviously that fire to compete at the highest level of motorsports is still there.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. Like it was neat too to see him last week at the Japanese Grand Prix, kind of poking around. I've always liked Sebastian Vettel. He seems like a pretty chill kind of person. Was a great racing driver, obviously four world championships. But you know, there's two very distinct phases to his career, and I guess you can have that discussion at some point. Like, where did the career start to sort of tail off a bit? Because I mean, he had some. He started out pretty good at Ferrari, but you know, they've been in slow kind of like, I don't want to say decline. They've been in the doldrums for quite a number of years now. I mean, you can just even ask Charles Leclerc, who's been there for quite a while.
Let's have that conversation a little bit, because I think over here in North America, legacy is really important in in team sports. Like you want to build a legacy. You want to collect championships and MVPs and all NBA titles and all-star appearances and Pro Bowl appearance and all those. Well, nobody actually appears in the Pro Bowl, but you want to be recognized with a Pro Bowl placement. But it looks
good on the resume.
Yeah, totally it does. It looks really good on the Wikipedia page. And Sebastian Vettel, you're right. Like it's interesting because I don't know how I don't know how to gauge his legacy. Like, obviously, 4 times world champion is exceptional. He came third place in the championship in 2015 in his first year with Ferrari in 2017 and 2018. He finished second in both of those years, a fairly distant second to the championship winner, Lewis Hamilton, but also ahead of Mercedes' other driver, Valtteri Bottas, in what could be argued was a superior car. And then things kind of started falling apart in 2019 with the cheating scandal and his constant clashes with Charles Leclerc. And then it was pretty clear that Ferrari had moved on. And then he made that transition to Aston Martin. And that car was a bit mid. Like, I don't know how to define his career, because I think some drivers are just consistently great. And he was exceptional. And then he was very good. And then it just kind of tailored off at the end. And a big part of that might be the car and the team that he was competing in. But I don't know how to frame his career. Like, obviously, 4 times world champion, one of the greatest of all time. But I just think it could have been more, maybe.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, where does he go at that time? Like, after he comes off the back of those 4 chips at Red Bull, who do we have? We've got Fernando Alonso as the guy at Ferrari. You have the duo of Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg at Mercedes. So then Fernando, he decides to break that relationship with Ferrari, move away. So Sebastian ends up going there, and it was tough, right? Because that was only going to be the only other really competitive seat that was out there, because you go into the turbo hybrid era and it's pretty obvious that Mercedes are miles ahead literally of everybody else. Red Bull is kind of third in that pack. So Ferrari is really the only option he has to go with a, quote unquote championship contending team. And it's pretty obvious right away that they're a step or so behind Mercedes in that game as well. But, in that time that he was with Ferrari, still managed to win a lot of races, figuratively speaking. I mean, he was basically the only person besides Nico Rosberg and Lewis Hamilton that was winning at that time. And then even afterwards, once Rosberg retired at the end of 2016 and Bottas comes on board, and, he's still able to win some, here and there. But it kind of like really sort of tapered out towards the end, right? And that it's, for somebody that was, winning world championships and lots of races afterwards, even with Ferrari, it kind of feels, I don't know, to me, it's like the candle. When you blow out a candle, it still kind of like smokes and smolders a little bit. It goes on and all of a sudden it's like gone, right? And you just kind of tell. And I think that's just with him, it's just like, he was so lucky to be in that Red Bull organization at the right time and be as good as he was, because he was just kind of went from Toro Rosso into Red Bull, wins the 4 championships. And then those opportunities to really land with the, it was either going to be with the Mercedes or nobody, because nobody else was going to beat Mercedes, starting from 2014. So I think the car has a lot to do with it. And when it came, I guess that's a bit of a side discussion. It's just like nobody was going to dislodge Rosberg and Hamilton from Mercedes, but maybe themselves. And that's a bit of a different discussion, because that was like pretty horrible. But he never really had that opportunity to get in that bona fide championship caliber car that he had at Red Bull anywhere else.
Daly, you make a really good point about, I think sometimes in Formula One, it's about circumstance and timing, right? That, if you're a world-class athlete in the NBA or the NFL, your team has the opportunity, the front office has the opportunity to build a team around you. And in F1, sometimes it's just fortune that he just happened to be part of an academy whose senior team was on the precipice of rolling out a series of phenomenal Red Bull cars, right? And so on the one hand, the timing with Red Bull was perfect, but then he goes to Ferrari, at exactly the worst possible time, because he's walking to Maranello at exactly the same time that Brackley and Brixworth are unleashing a succession of Mercedes AMG monsters on the world. And I wanted to share, because I'd forgotten this, but obviously 2014 Mercedes destroyed the championship. But 2015, when they were possibly equally as good, you know, Lewis wins the title. I think he wins the title with three races left. I think he won in Austin. He finishes on 381 points. His teammate Nico Rosberg finished on 322 points. Sebastian Vettel that season finished on 278 points. Like, he was only 44 points behind a Mercedes driver that year. And the Mercedes driver, who, by the way, would go on to win the 2016 championship. 2016 was kind of a fallback year because Daniel Ricciardo snuck into third place. But then in 2017 to 2018, he was second in the championship. So really, when you look at his time with Ferrari, he was deprived of the possibility of winning a championship just because that Mercedes was so good. And I don't think in hindsight or even in the moment, anyone should have realistically expected that car to win a title. So considering that, like, yeah, he's got a couple of chapters. There's that Red Bull chapter, which was utter dominance, and he's got that Ferrari chapter, which was really strong to start, but they were just up against it with Mercedes. And then the Ferrari thing kind of falls apart, and then he goes to Aston Martin. And you're right, like, where else is he going to go in 21? Like, Red Bull had an open seat, but ultimately they committed that to Sergio Perez. And was it the right thing to bring back your former Alpha driver at the tail end of his career when you have Nico Rosberg on the cusp of greatness? Like, that probably didn't make sense. So to your point, like, if you wanted to continue driving in 2021 and you wanted to get paid, because I'm sure Lawrence Stroll paid him well, like, where else was he going to go?
Yeah, that's just it. So it's a very interesting discussion. I think that, you know, to decide what Sebastian's legacy is, it's just, you know, I think everybody might have a little bit, let's just say it's complicated.
Like ChatGPT says, it's super subjective.
It's super subjective. There you go. We need to clap, or, you know, cue the laugh track at the same time. Okay, next story here. IndyCar has announced a 17-race schedule for the 2024 NTT IndyCar season, which kicks off Sunday, March 10th at the streets of St. Petersburg. Then 2 weeks later is the Thermal Club Million Dollar Challenge. That's a non-points race. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Then back to racing. You know, we were very critical this year. Well, and there was a cancellation of the Chinese Grand Prix, and they just weren't able to backfill that. But after that, the $1 million challenge at the Thermal Club there on March 24th, then you have almost an entire month until they hit the streets of Long Beach on April 21st, and then it comes really, really thick and fast. You have Indy goes on Sunday, May 26th, and then the championship winds up all the way at the end of the season, obviously. That'll be Sunday, September 15th in Nashville. So there you go. And they're going to have like two races at the Milwaukee Mile, race one and two, 2 weeks apart. You got the Portland International Raceway in there, Toronto, at the middle or tail end of July. Couple of races there, middle of July as well, on Saturday and Sunday, July 13th and 14th at the Iowa Speedway. Mid-Ohio and Laguna Seca, you know, the corkscrew there is always a classic. Road America, Streets of Detroit, and a lot of good stuff coming up. So they're also going to, on the 11th of May, which is Saturday, they're going to race on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on the road course before they get into all the qualifying in Indy itself. So very, very exciting. Okay, so Mark, I'll let you take the next one because there's a tie into Indy, and that's the ongoing story or saga or epic or question mark, whatever you want to call it.
It's all of those things, daily. You tease all of those things, right? It's this ongoing saga, and I had predicted a couple of weeks ago that the FIA would come forward with their recommendations about a new team in September. That didn't happen, and I'd kind of assumed it would have happened this week because we had this two-week gap between the Japanese Grand Prix and hitting to Qatar and Doha and things like that. But ultimately, the ongoing speculation and the reporting is that the FIA has chosen to reject three potential applications. And the speculation, because the FIA never formally announced how many teams had submitted an expression of interest, but the understanding was there was four. And ultimately, it's now reported that three have been rejected. And widely, the speculation is that Andretti, Cadillac, the combined forces of the two are going to get the nod. And of course, at that point, it'll be up to the FOM to either in themselves reject this or negotiate. But it sounds like this is this is going to happen, not this week. And you and I had talked about we were going to do an emergency podcast, but maybe at some point in the very, very near future. A couple of things that I thought were pretty interesting about this is one, Lucky Suns, which is that Asian-based team, aspiring Asian-based team, who had made a bid that was allegedly rejected. They had announced that they had funding in place to negotiate an anti-dilution or an expansion fee of $600 million, which I thought was really interesting. And despite that, they weren't granted the rights to negotiate with the FOM on a placement. But ultimately, I think we're getting closer. This article that we're kind of speaking to here on carscoops.com, I've never heard of them before, but this is a pretty decent article by Sam D. Smith, really talks about the value of this partnership. And I think I at least have really downplayed the involvement of GM. And in fact, I think I've been super negative about it because Andretti came forward and they announced, hey, we want to be on the F1 grid. And you and I have talked so much about how Michael Andretti just stormed into the paddock in Miami and went door to door at the hospitality trailers with a sheet of paper demanding that team principals sign their name to commit to supporting his bid, which was total BS. But ultimately, I think one of the rejections was, hey, what are you bringing to F1? And earlier this year, I think in January, February, they announced a partnership with GM, that GM was going to be a manufacturer backing via their Cadillac brand. And of course, Cadillac's a strong brand in North America that has growing reach globally. And I think they thought that was going to be sufficient. You and I dissected this very quickly, and we realized that based on the timelines that Andretti hopes to achieve to get to the sport, 25 or 26, that realistically Cadillac had no time to develop a power unit. And as we dug a little bit deeper, it became clear that ultimately Andretti's vision is to use a Renault power unit and badge it as a Cadillac power unit. So Cadillac GM's, kind of, I would say, contributions to the car would probably be more technical, although I don't know what that would look like unless it's chassis, unless it's the monocoque or something like that. But what we're learning more and more now, and GM is starting to open up to this idea, is that, look, we want to be involved from the jump, but given the timelines, we just don't have the resources or the technical expertise to develop a Formula One engine. And furthermore, we're not willing to start developing one at this time unless we have the commitment to join the grid, right? Like, if you're GM, why are you going to start spending hundreds of millions of dollars developing an F1 power unit if you don't have a car to put it in? So I think what we're learning now is that, hey, that Renault power unit would ultimately be a short-term fit. And that if Andretti's given that spot on the grid, Cadillac would sign up to developing their own power unit. And that would probably be ready by 27, 28, 29. So, you know, while it was very uncool conceptually, this idea that GM was just going to rebadge a Renault power unit, I think as we unpack this, that's a short-term requirement to get the car on the grid and get them competing, while Cadillac then has the timelines to build an F1 power unit. So again, nothing revolutionary here, nothing that we haven't spoken about before, but as the days go by, like sooner or later, there's going to be an announcement. The FIA is going to approve or recommend this bid, and then it's going to be up to the FOM. And that is when the fireworks are going to start to fly.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting. And I think I already know the answer to this one, but is there any sort of tie-in between Renault and GM at the corporate level? I don't think so, right?
That's the weird thing, right? Like, and you and I have talked about this in the past, that the relationship between global automotive OEMs is pretty incestuous. Like, it feels like in history, they've all owned a piece of each other at some point. And even if they didn't, there's all sorts of collaborations. Like, you can talk right now about the fact that Toyota is sharing a platform with Subaru in the BRZ and the Toyota 86. Like, they share a chassis and there's some badge engineering going on there. But then Toyota does the exact same thing with BMW, that BMW is basically building a car that Toyota rebadges as a Supra. But again, if anyone knows, I don't think that there's any kind of collaborative partnerships between the Renault and the GM group today. That said, if you don't know, GM had, since World War II, had a very strong presence in Europe, particularly through the Vauxhall and the Opel brands, which were wholly owned GM subsidiaries. They were largely autonomous from the US operations, but in the last decade, GM's almost entirely got out of Europe and they focused on North America, Central and South America, and China through the Buick brand is a big, big market for them as well. But I don't believe they have any relationship to Renault today.
Interesting. So we'll wait and see. And it's funny, too, that Mohammed bin Sulaym has become very, very quiet on the topic, but be interested to see, you know, when this is. Because we've been talking about doing this emergency pod now. It seems like little bits kind of like uncorroborated, unsubstantiated little nuggets kind of pop up here or there. It's just like it feels like this is the day for the emergency. Oh, wait, here we go. This is the day for the emergency. Oh, no, here we go. This is, no, and it kind of goes back and forth. And we're just like, dude, we can't do the show because it just becomes wild. An idle speculation. So I wonder how long it's going to take. But it's interesting too, you know, perhaps they won't, you know, open up too much on it, but it would be nice to know, like, because there was what, like three potential bidders? Was it four in the end? There were several that were involved in addition to Andretti, which always seems like the, I wouldn't say a slam dunk, but seemed to be the strongest of all of it. It'd just be kind of interesting if they could kind of crack that open. It's like, where did Andretti, should they get that that berth? What did they do differently? What made them that much more attractive? Was it just the whole GM partnership? Was it like everything? And like, how bad or how deficient were the other ones? Just be totally. Like, okay, like what are you bringing to Formula One? It's like, well, like nothing. Okay, see ya. So I don't know. It'd be kind of cool to find that.
I totally agree. I think we can speculate a little bit on that. I think if you look at these other teams, they were very aspirational. And it was like, hey, if you give us a slot on the grid, these are the things we're going to do. And I think in the Andretti case, it's like, hey, here's the infrastructure we already have. Here's the potential partnership with Renault that we've already agreed to, that theirs was far less aspirational and far more concrete, that there was a foundation to it, right? And then, of course, Andretti also has this pedigree of racing and expertise that they can lean into and relationships with existing suppliers. But I would be equally as fascinated. Like, I'd love to see the report card for each one of those bid, like what they did well and what they didn't do well.
Well, what did Andretti they just changed their name recently, didn't they? Like Andretti Motorsports is now what, like Andretti Global Motorsports or something like that.
Yeah. So we reported this a couple of weeks ago, and by report, I mean, read off somebody else's report. But according to beyondtheflag.com, Andretti Autosport plan to rebrand and operate as Andretti Global beginning in the 2024 IndyCar season, the team announced. Andretti Autosport continue to make waves as the IndyCar sales season, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, Andretti Autosport to become Andretti Global starting in 2024.
Interesting. All right. Well, the next story, and this is one I think you know, kind of resonates a little bit more with you and I, but I'm sure a lot of our audience too. But this is a story, and it's a translation of an article that of an interview that Sergio Perez did with De Limburger, which is a newspaper in the Netherlands, and apparently he decided to hire a mental coach this summer. So the article that we have the translation of, and I'll read the entire thing because you know, just to give a lot of context to it. So Checo goes on to say, quote, after Miami, things started to get worse for me. I felt like I was driving another car that didn't suit me so well. Subsequently, it was not possible to get into Q3 a number of times, which shattered my confidence. This also made driving a lot more difficult. I had a lot of trouble with it in the summer. At the beginning, I was up there and competing, but it all changed onwards. I was driving without any confidence. At certain points, I couldn't figure it out anymore. That was very tough. You drive for a top team, the pressure to perform increases rapidly. My confidence came back when I realized that I won races on my own earlier this year. I dare say that I am now 100% again, and I'm convinced that I can take a shot at the world title next year. Formula One is my sport, my life, my passion, but when you're having such a hard time at work, it's difficult to be cheerful at home with your wife and children. That's why I hired a mental coach, because my family deserves to have that cheerful father at home. Together with my coach, I started working on becoming the best version of myself at home, but also as a driver. I decided not to give up. In the meantime, I also continued to work hard with the engineers to resolve at least some issues. As a result, I'm looking to find positivity again. I am now 33 years old, but I am still learning every day on the track, but also certainly also outside it. Partly because of this, I will never get enough of Formula One. It is truly amazing what this sport still gives me. I'm grateful to Red Bull for giving me the opportunity to play for a top team. After all, I am a driver who did not come from their own training path. It would be great if I could end my career here, but being a driver for them, for this team is not easy. Red Bull Racing operates in a different way than most teams. but that is also why they are also so successful. In my opinion, their car is built from a different approach from the other teams. It needs time, and you must get used to that. And of course, you have to deal with Max Verstappen as a teammate. The past has proven this task, that pressure. I sometimes call it the toughest track in Formula One, end quote. So it's kind of interesting in there, like that was just, to me, that looks like a Google Translate, but I think it kind of captures the essence of it. And this hasn't been an easy year for Sergio Perez. I kind of feel, maybe this is just me reading between the lines, that I feel like he's putting a very positive twist on it. He says he's trying to find positivity with his mental health coach and everything, but I get the feeling that he must have been in a really, really dark place at one point, where, you know, he had to reach out to somebody else on the outside to, you know, help focus, bring him back. And the fact that he opens up and says he wasn't really the best version of himself when he was at home with the wife and the kids and all that stuff. And when it affects like your family life like that, you know, it must be pretty tough. And I mean, and he's not the first person to talk about this. I mean, one of the reasons that that Nico Rosberg said that he retired, and I remember this because this came like pretty quick on the news of his retirement, was that he just wasn't prepared to go through another season defending his world championship, going up against Lewis Hamilton in the mental battle and everything that goes into it. It was just so much. It's just like, you know what? I've been in the sport for a while. I got my chip. I'm in a good place. Let's just call it a day and move on. But I think that that article is pretty revealing. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I really do agree with you, my friend. And I thought a lot about this because, you know, over the years, people have commented on the fact that Red Bull is a relatively toxic environment to be a driver that isn't also simultaneously a world champion like Sebastian Vettel or Max Verstappen. And we don't know what's happening. And again, when you're a Formula One driver and you sign up to be a Formula One driver with a world championship contending team, obviously, I think you do so knowing that the pressures are going to be crushing. The media, social media, the fans, people in the stands, the analysts, the pundits, the fans, like the pressure is just unrelenting. I think that it's unnecessarily compounded at Red Bull because of the things that certain people within that organization say in public that, look, you know what? We all know what's happening with Sergio Perez. He knows, the team knows, his family knows, the fans know. And just the fact that you have somebody like a consultant and kind of the driver, kind of development chief or whatever you want to call Helmut Marko, like constantly and publicly commenting on his performance, I think is challenging. Like it's one thing, my friend, like imagine this scenario, and I'm trying to contextualize this for people at home. Like, you know what, if you're struggling at work, ideally your boss pulls you into the office and just checks in, man, how are things going? How's things with the family? Look, you know what, I've observed some things and you can talk through it. You get some feedback and you can walk away. I don't know that that's how it operates at Red Bull, that it's like, it would be like my boss going on Twitter and my boss would never do this because he's amazing, but it's like, it would be like my boss going on Twitter and commenting that, hey, look, you know what? Hamilton's got a British passport and British people don't have the same work ethic as North America. Like imagine that is, and maybe that's an extreme like analogy, but like that's kind of the environment that Sergio Perez lives in. And all that said, like, I assume that behind closed doors, the conversations with people like Christian Horner are cordial and professional and tactical and strategic. But based on what we see in public, I don't know that that's necessarily the case. And then just the fact that Helmut Marko can make these comments without any consequence is pretty telling about maybe what's going on there. But again, all of that said, you know what, I totally sympathize with Sergio Perez, but what I think we're seeing at Red Bull now is no different than what happened to Pierre Gasly and Alex Albon and Daniel Kvyat. And like there's a long pattern of this with this team that on the one hand, I totally sympathize with him, but he also committed to that. You know what I mean? And maybe it's because, again, you're an F1 driver and you need to commit to the best car possible. But ultimately, maybe he should have known. But having said that, that doesn't excuse, obviously, anything that Helmut Marko and things... and such have done. But yeah, it's a tough situation. And if you have mental health conditions, I don't know that he does. Certainly they would be compounded in a moment in a situation like that. So tough for sure.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and at one point in the past, I was in a position, a job that I had at the time where I felt like I was constantly, you know, like on the verge of like losing my job or just getting reprimanded all the time. It puts you in a really, really horrible place. You know, it's just like, it's difficult enough as it is getting up and going to work every day and the challenges. I mean, you and I are lucky because we love what we do for work. We enjoy getting up and doing it. And you're nodding politely there, Mark.
No, okay. I love what I do. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, I know. I'm just poking fun. But, you know, when you get into a situation, because a lot of people aren't there, and then when you get into situations, especially with, you know, quote unquote, normal people like ourselves, where, you know, you're not raking in millions of dollars and you've got all the different, you know, pressures, especially in this, you know, crazy environment that we live in with, like, you know, massive inflation and high cost of living, et cetera. So, I mean, you know, that's what we face, but Sergio, he faces a lot of pressure on a different front. So, I mean, it's all like a little bit of perspective, but whatever it is, it's not a good place for a person to be. We're just not designed as people, I think, to really have to try and absorb that kind of pressure. And you can see why that, there's so many, you know, people suffer from mental illness that, I forget the exact, when it comes, there's a couple of terms. I'm just trying to think of what they are. Like, there's different types of like depression and anxiety that can be brought on like stress and stuff like that. And, you know, these are things that you and I are both very, you know, passionate about, because, you know, depression and anxiety is something that I've dealt with in the past. And, you know, it's not fun. It is, it's a really, really tough place to be. So I hope that Sergio is in a better place. Like I say, I feel just kind of like reading between the lines that he's really putting a positive spin on it. I mean, it looked like, you know, we were starting to see him come back again, but, you know, he had a pretty massive setback last weekend. And I think a lot of people are just waiting for, you know, Red Bull to come along and say, oh, we're giving the seat in 24 to, or in 2025 to Danny Ricciardo or Yuki Tsunoda, or, you know, fill in the blank, right? I think it almost, to me, I almost feel like it's a bygone conclusion that he's going to be replaced, right? And, you know, that can't be fun for him either.
Yeah, I totally agree, man. And, like, obviously, he's under contract through 24, but as you stated earlier, like, F1 contracts really are pretty valueless, to be totally blunt. I like your point about the fact, too, that, look, you know what, suffering from, you know, mental health conditions or suffering from depression or suffering from anxiety isn't uncommon. But I think oftentimes the symptoms and the experience is heightened by your experience at work. And I think you make that great point about, mm-hmm. Hey, look, you know, I was in a work environment once where I felt like I was constantly being reprimanded and I was always going to be fired. And I think sometimes that's a byproduct of just shit, I was going to swear, but just terrible leadership, right? That, you know what, if you're struggling mm-hmm. at work, you know what, you know what, your leader needs to pull you aside and have a conversation and be honest and tactile. Like, hey, here's the things you're doing well. Here's where you're struggling. Let's work on these things. Is there anything going on at home? Is there anything I can help you with? And have those honest conversations. But when all you get is the reprimand and there's no coaching, there's no development, there's no instruction, there's no learning, then your mental health deteriorates rapidly because you're not hearing the good stuff and you don't see a way out of it. And I think for Sergio, like that's kind of his scenario, his experience right now, which is you have Helmut Marko, who is publicly challenging him and demeaning him in front of an audience of millions of people. And then it becomes an echo chamber because everyone starts repeating mm-hmm. those things. And he can't go on social media because he's going to see it. His friends are hearing it. His family's hearing it. His kids are hearing it. And it's hard to escape from. And again, you know, those conversations can happen, but they happen in behind closed doors. That you can't have those things in public. And again, it's all juicy because it gives us something to talk about and it gets aggregated and it gets retweeted. But in terms of running a professional racing organization, there's no place for that.
Yeah, totally agree. So I hope, like I say, he's in a good place. So next story I want to talk about, Jessica Hawkins, the Aston Martin ambassador, former guest on this show, became this past weekend the first woman to drive a Formula One car in 5 years. Hasn't been done since 2018. And Jessica and Felipe Drugovich got behind the wheel of an AMR 21, put a bunch of laps in. So that's a very, very exciting deal. I still have a bone to pick with Jessica because she was a stunt driver for the latest James Bond movie, and I tried to pry it out of her, like some sort of kind of like anything, and you know, she just couldn't do it, wasn't able to. And of course, you don't want any spoilers and things like that when you're under an NDA and they got a big motion picture. But what a very, very cool opportunity for her. I think we're actually going to do some F1 Academy update a little bit later in the show. Okay, so the next one here is this third car rule breach for Williams. What's going on with this one? Because I'm not quite, I don't know, maybe it's because it's been a busy day. Maybe, you know, I just haven't had enough coffee, Mark, but I'm not quite able to get my mind around this one.
Oh, Daly, what's going on here? Hoping you were going to take this one. So let me take a stab at this. So if you've read books like Mark Priestley's The Mechanic, you know that through much of F1's history, it wasn't unusual to have a third car in the garage. And they would call it a T car. And that T car would actually have its own cluster of mechanics. And some teams might even have a fourth car. And the intent was that, hey, look, if your car as a driver, if your car sputtered out in qualifying or practice, or even on the way to the starting grid, you could run back to the pits and jump in the T car. And that T car would be ready, it would be fueled, and you could go and compete. And in 2007, 2008, as a means of cutting costs during the midst of the global economic crisis, the T car concept was scrapped. So there could be no more T cars, there was no more third cars. But what teams are allowed to do is bring a monocoque, a chassis, an extra chassis to the track. Because you know what? More often than not, when you crash a car, no matter how bad it looks, those mechanics can work their magic. They'll replace the floor, they'll replace the wings, they'll replace the side pods, the wheels, the suspension, the brakes. They can replace all of that. But if the monocoque, the chassis, if that is structurally damaged, it's done. It's a write-off. That no matter how much people say it can be repaired, from a structural integrity piece, it's gone. So when when Logan Sargeant had his major, major crash on the weekend, I think that what Williams discovered was that, hey, this car isn't salvageable, right? That there might be some individual components, but the car itself is basically a write-off. So they had, in the back of a lorry, all of the teams bring an additional monocoque. They brought out the actual chassis and they started building up the car. Now, for reasons that I've yet to really understand, FIA officials weren't necessarily satisfied with the timing of the work that Williams had conducted on the car. And I'm going to quote here from therace.com. F1 technical delegate Joe Bauer felt that 2 hours after qualifying officially ended, Williams built up spare chassis to more than an assembly comprising a survival shell as defined by the rules, and that this has to be considered as a third car available to the competitor. competitor. And the article continues, the regulations around spare chassis are designed to stop teams having a third ready-to-go car built up and on standby. As a result, the matter was referred to the stewards, who shared his view and found Williams had broken the rule that states each competitor may not have more than two cars available at any time during an event. So it sounds like, hey, they were onside by having the chassis, but they were effectively offside in the timing of the buildup of that car. And ultimately, because of that, it effectively qualified as a third car, which put them offside with the rules. And as a result, they ultimately got the penalty. But it's interesting because, one, it gives us the opportunity to reflect back on a very different era in Formula One. And I don't know if you remember this, Mark, but there was a time when Michael Schumacher might have had multiple T cars available to him, and he would take all of them out during different sessions in free practice one and free practice two and free practice three, and would make a final decision on what car he was going to take to the grid almost moments before the race. So we talk about F1 and kind of contracting costs and the cost cap and things like that. It is remarkable that there was an era where there was a T car available at all times, at least one T car and a separate group of mechanics. But ultimately, I think in an effort to cut costs, the sport had said, hey, you can't have a T car, but you can have a monocoque. But unfortunately, based on the timing of the rebuild, it effectively did end up qualifying as a T car. So they took a penalty as a result, which I think is super, super, super interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it leads into another discussion here too, because despite all the crashes and some of the negative publicity that Logan Sargeant is getting, because we talked about it on Sunday after the race, there was that one really, really sad camera shot during qualifying on Saturday where they panned over to one of the mechanics in the Williams garage, literally head in hands and looking quite upset about the whole thing, just kind of realizing, I'm going to be up for the next 24 hours putting this car back together so he could go racing on Sunday afternoon. But despite that, Williams actually think that, in spite of the fact that Logan has had some issues keeping it on the track and breaking cars like that, they believe it. And the exact quote is, masks his steady improvement. And then, you know, I just couldn't help, you know, my reaction when I saw him put it into the barrier at the, during qualifying on Saturday is like, that's another one, you know, how much longer is this guy going to last? So it's very, very interesting, right? So before the race on Sunday, Williams head of vehicle performance, fellow by the name of Dave Robinson, said that he felt that Sargeant's crashes have taken, it's really taken away from what he's done this year, and the fact that he's improving, and the fact that he's getting close to Alex Albon in some lap times at Suzuka practice. Anyways, Robson had the following to say, quote, I guess inevitably they catch the headlines, don't they? When he was asked about the crashes by Motorsport Magazine, he goes on to say, quote, I think it has kind of amassed his steady performance, and this weekend was actually going really well. It's such a difficult circuit to come to, and he went about it really well on Friday, built on that on Saturday, and lost in the very last corner of the first lap, and really it was quite a minor mistake. It's just at that corner, once you touch the grass, you're in a whole heap of trouble, and it was a real shame. But yeah, I think it's fair that the crashes since Zandvoort have masked what otherwise has clearly been some steady improvement, end quote. So we'll just we'll put that one out there and let everybody else make their own call on that. I want to talk now about McLaren. So there's another article over at motorsport.com by Jonathan Noble and Matt Summerfield, and they go over some of the big changes that McLaren have made with the MCL60, and these concept changes that they believe have really transformed the car. And obviously, you know, McLaren have become a real bright spot this season, when it seems like there's been very, very few topics many times, days and weeks to talk about other than Red Bull. So the areas that that they believe were these, these concept changes that have really done wonders for McLaren is an outwash front wing, wider side pods with water slides. So we're making a trip here to Mount Splashmore or something like that. We'll talk about that in a second. A floor edge wing and a beam wing and more beam wing efficiency. So all these things combined have made quite a bit of a difference for McLaren. What do you think, Mark? Want to jump in here with the technical side?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'm qualified to, but I think Jonathan Noble does a pretty good job of summarizing the things that we know, right? Like, I think one, when a team makes fundamental changes to the floor of the car, which is critical because that's where the vast amount of the downforce is coming from, we really don't get the opportunity to see that. And even if we do, it's really hard to comp that against what the competitors are doing. But what we can comment on are the things that are visible to us. And he does a pretty good job of summarizing some of those things, including the outwash front wing. Says Jonathan Noble, McLaren has joined other teams in pursuing a front wing design, which delivers as much outwash effect as possible. This has been achieved through better managing the gaps between the flaps and the end plate, as well as the shaping of each aerofoil across the span. The other one, wider side pods. And this one's really interesting because when we talk about side pods, it's not just about the aerodynamic surfaces. It's about the packaging of the cooling and the hardware that resides underneath it, right? That you can come to an understanding that, hey, we can transform our side pods. We can go with a wider side pod design. We can have these really deep kind of funneling water slides. But in doing so, you need to repackage all of the cooling and all of the mechanicals that kind of lay behind that. So it's not simply saying, hey, we're going to strip off this side pod and put on a new one. In doing so, you need to be committed because you need to have to rework everything that lies underneath that. Now, the design that they have isn't fundamentally different than what we saw in 2022, that as far back as last year, they were trying to borrow heavily from what Red Bull had been doing. But says Andrea Stella from McLaren in this article from Jonathan Noble, it's now very much noticeable how much wider it is, referring to the side pod. We're trying to create a clear pathway for energizing the air flow. And then a couple of other things too, return of the floor edge wing. So this is something that they trialed a little bit in 2022, abandoned, and then gone back to, and says Jonathan Noble, the key to success with the ground effects cars is the design of the floor because it offers so much downforce when you get it right, which we know. The key here is that this amplifies that effect. So this has really, really worked for them. And this is something that you can see on the back of the floor edge as you approach the rear wheels. And really for us, it just looks like slots and wings and dividers and different shapes and things like that. But ultimately it helps reinforce the effect of the downforce. And then the other one, and this is something that all of the teams are trying to emulate from Red Bull. And one of the things that people, I think, gasp at with the RB19 is how effective its DRS is. That when that DRS wing opens, the car is gone. That the drag that's being reduced is astronomical versus the rest of the field. So one of the things that they're trying to do here, so when we talk about beam wing efficiency, which is what you referred to in a moment ago, it's how can we capture the essence of what Red Bull is doing? And DRS ultimately stands for drag reduction system, right? That the wings create drag, and when you open that slot, it reduces the amount of drag. But for whatever reason, the configuration and the styling of the aerodynamics on the rear wing of that Red Bull, when that DRS slot opens, the drag just vanishes in a way that other teams haven't been able to achieve. And it's speculated, and Jonathan Noble talks about it here, that they've done a lot of work here to emulate what has made the RB19 really successful from a DRS perspective. So those are four things that we can see. We don't really know what's happened with the floor. We don't really know what's happened under those aerodynamic surfaces. But it's been pretty exceptional. And Daly, I was thinking this when I was driving earlier today, that ultimately, if I'm Mercedes and I'm looking at McLaren and the strides that they're making with the resources that they have versus the resources that we have, one, it should be pretty encouraging for you that, hey, this team is being so successful with our power unit. And again, when you're a customer team and you buy a power unit, you cannot modify it. Like, you cannot open it, you cannot tamper with it, that you have to take it as it comes. So one, it must be pretty inspiring to know that, hey, a team is being this successful with our power unit. But on the other hand, it must be pretty dispiriting. Is that a word? I don't know. It must be a little bit depressing to know that, hey, this customer team is effectively making these strides, and that if you were to amplify the Red Bull, McLaren experience from Austria Silverstone to the beginning of the season, they would be significantly ahead of where Mercedes is. So very, very interesting.
Yeah, and it is interesting to think about just like the gains that they've made and just how good that Red Bull is. I mean, we know it's an absolute monster. I mean, the entire package, the car, the power unit, it's absolutely amazing. But I would be interested to hear, and I'm sure we'll find this out at some point, like what is the gain that that the McLaren have or that they've made over the course of the season to where they were at the first couple of races. I mean, they were not like just towards the back. They were literally the back of the pack there. They were just so slow and uncompetitive. So to get where they are now is it's absolutely mind-blowing, especially in this day and age, because the cost cap, you just don't really expect to see something like this. And they've made monstrous gains to get from where they were at, race 1, 2, and 3 to where we are now at like race, 17, 16, 15, whatever it is. It's almost unheard of. And it kind of like makes me think, I look like Mercedes, what are you guys doing? Ferrari, what are you guys doing? So it's like if McLaren can do this in season and close the gap to the front there as much as they have, it's absolutely astonishing.
I completely agree. Completely agree, my friend.
Yeah. So you know what, Mark? It is that time. We're going to move away from Formula One. We're going to get to something else. So take it away. It's return to MotoGP Corner, my friend.
MotoGP Corner, and it's been a while since I've given a bit of a championship update, but the championship progresses, and I think a couple of the big takeaways for me so far this year is one that, obviously, if you've been listening to the show, Ducati, the Italian manufacturer, has been absolutely dominating the championship. And for much of their history in MotoGP, they'd always been this, I don't want to say an afterthought, but they'd always been a disappointment that their road bikes have such presence and such glamour that it just never seemed to translate into success on the MotoGP circuit. But that's changed. Honda has fallen away, which we've talked to at length, and Yamaha has fallen away, and we've talked to at length. And obviously this championship is a Ducati kind of landslide. But I think one of the things that I find really interesting is that there was a brand new team on the grid last year, effectively a Ducati customer team, but the Italian-based Mooney VR46 racing team last year joined the grid. This is the MotoGP team that is owned by Valentino Rossi. It joined the grid last year, finished 8th in the championship, which is pretty respectable for a brand new team. What is incredible is that so far this championship, and I think we have 7 races left, Japan, Indonesia, Australia, Thailand, Malaysia, Qatar, and Valencia, that this team second year in the MotoGP championship is setting second in the team championship, which is crazy. So right now, Prima Pramac Racing, which is the factory Ducati team, is sitting first on 436 points. Mooney VR46 Racing team, effectively the freshman sophomore. I always forget how Americans speak about high school, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, but the sophomore MotoGP team is sitting second in the championship on 383 points with the same riders that they had last year, which is pretty remarkable. So that's pretty cool. But a quick update from a rider's perspective, a couple of cool things happening here. One, the championship still is relatively wide open. You know, right now sitting on number one or sitting in the number one spot, Francesco Bagnaia, the Ducati rider for Ducati Lenovo team. He's currently sitting on 292 points. Jorge Martin, the Spanish rider, also riding a Ducati, but for Prima Pramac Racing, he sits on 279 points. Marco Bezzecchi, the Italian rider with Mooney VR46 Racing team, Valentino's team. He's currently sitting in third on 248 points. So with 7 races left, the championship is wide open, which is amazing. And that's mostly based on the fact that unfortunately Bagnaia had a retirement in Indonesia recently, in India, of course, the first annual Indian MotoGP race, which is pretty cool. Bagnaia retired. So that kind of blew the championship wide open. Of course, this was also this last weekend, the first time that we've been in India. And there was a lot of speculation that maybe this race wasn't going to happen. A lot of riders, media, team personnel had trouble even getting visas to get into the country. There was speculation that the race was going to be very, very unsafe. Ultimately, it went off largely without a hitch once everyone was able to get into the country and get a hotel room. Marco Bezzecchi finished first. Jorge Martin finished second. And in a surprise, Fabio Quartararo, the Yamaha rider, finished third, which I think is his second podium of the year. He currently sits on 105 points. So some pretty cool news there. The other thing, and this is actually a story that I thought about putting in the outline, is that there's some news this week, some speculation, some rumors surfacing that Indian race promoters have been negotiating with Liberty on a return of the Indian Grand Prix to the Formula One calendar. And of course, a decade ago, they joined the calendar and they dropped off pretty quickly. MotoGP has now returned or has arrived in India for the first time using the exact same circuit. But now there's this growing speculation that possibly Formula One is going to go there. Of course, Formula One's going to have a 24 race calendar next year. And I don't know how they're going to fit on any more races because of course, China's coming back. I'm going to pivot now, my friend, to a little bit of F1 Academy before we wrap this one up for the night. But if you've forgotten, I think a lot of us have, because it's been so long since we've had an F1 Academy race, but F1 Academy is coming back. Of course, F1 Academy season, their inaugural season, is going to conclude in a couple of weeks in Austin. So their final race weekend will also be the race weekend of the U.S. Grand Prix at Austin at the Circuit of the Americas. So maybe a couple of quick refreshers here that if you've forgotten, and I wouldn't blame you if you have, because it's been a while since we've had a race. The Spanish driver, Marta Garcia, is currently sitting in first on 235 points. Lena Bueller, the Swiss driver, is sitting in second on 187 points. And Hamda, friend of the show, Hamda Alkobasi, the Emirati driver, is sitting third on 179 points. Now, remember, each race weekend has three races. They have a 30-minute race, a 20-minute reverse grid race, and then a 30-minute race. The first and third races are worth 25 points to the race winner, and the second race is worth 10 points to the race winner. So all of that to say, this championship, well, kind of over because mathematically it's going to be really difficult for Bueller to catch Garcia, isn't officially over. So that championship is yet to be decided, which is really, really interesting. And then from a team perspective, MP Motorsports sits on 372 points and Prema, who seems to be involved in every open wheel racing championship in the world, is currently sitting in second on 349 points. Another real quick comment as well. You talked about friend of the show, Jessica Hawkins, who's been on the show before. Man, we've built up, not this year so much, but in the past, we've had a lot of really great guests. She's actually going to be joining Tim Haraney, friend of the show, on his podcast this week, and he's going to be asking her about her experience testing with the F1 team. So if you love Tim Haraney, and we all do, make sure you tune in to check that out. And then one final news story of the day is that the W Series, and I think we'd all kind of assume that the W Series had faded into the oblivion, faded into the night. Of course, it had competed in 2019, 2021 and 2022, at least part of 2022 before their funding fell through. According to PlanetF1.com's Henry Valentine, the W Series officially put up for sale with a quote-unquote exciting opportunity to get back racing again. He writes, W Series and its assets has now officially been put up for sale by its joint administrators in the hope of the all-female series being able to go racing again. And of course, I think you and I kind of spoke at length last year about how disappointed we were that neither the FIA nor Formula One were willing to front the capital, keep that championship alive and invest in it. But I think clearly the reason was that they had, especially F1, they had blueprints to roll out F1 Academy for this year. And knowing the success that F1 Academy has had this year, especially in growing an audience, despite the fact that it's been almost impossible to watch the races live, I think that's where their motivation is. And I think if somebody wants to take a chance and invest in the W Series, that's great. But I think that it would be an awfully, awfully big challenge to go up now against the F1-backed F1 Academy. So my friend, that's all I got on MotoGP Corner and F1 Academy Compound for this week.
There you go. I've run out of jingles to play, so we'll wrap it up there. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in this week. Thank you for downloading and listening to the show. If you want to get in touch, send us a message on X. You can find us there at scooterf1pod at gmail.com. Or sorry, at scooterf1pod on X. Email us at scooterf1pod at gmail.com. And if you enjoy the show, head on over to Spotify or Apple or wherever you're listening to your podcast. Leave us a five-star rating review, share it with a friend. We would really, really appreciate that. And it's been a long day for both myself and Mr. Mark Hamilton, so we're going to leave it there. Thank you, everybody. Take care. We'll be back again very, very soon. Bye for now.